RN.
Turn on.
Online.
Download.
And yes, good morning, Natasha Mitchell, back with you after a stint offshore, mostly offline. Always feels liberating. So I'm jet lagged, but very excited to be back in the Life Matters chair this week. Kind of a curious time to be out of the country, I found, as a new but old Prime Minister was catapulted into place. I have to admit, I didn't really miss witnessing that circus at close quarters, but it's always interesting to see how others see us and the soap opera of Australian political life through that long lens of the Northern Hemisphere. My thanks to the ever brilliant Robbie Buck, wonderful man, for taking the show's reins so skillfully. He's back with you later today for the inside sleeve and more besides, here on RN, of course. And back to work, the team tell me they've been pulling together a whole thread of very interesting stories about our lives at work for this week. Starting today with what it takes to be a risk taker. Are you one? When you're feeling sick or in pain and you go to the doctor, what do you expect? You probably want a diagnosis, some understanding of what's ailing you, presumably a quick or effective solution. One of our guests today says that the use of prescription drugs in Australia is on the rise. What this means exactly is still to be determined, but what is known and of concern to Professor Paul Haber is that some prescription drugs are leading to addiction and sometimes to death through overdose, a very serious concern. Paul is the head of addiction at Sydney University and the medical director of drug health services based at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. He's presenting new research at the International Narcotics Research Conference in Cairns today. Good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning.
And also joining us today is Professor Louisa Degenhardt from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre and also Margaret Millington, who really knows this story all too closely. Margaret's son Simon died in 2010 from an accidental overdose of prescription painkillers. Margaret, thank you for joining us. Louisa, you too.
Thanks very much.
Paul, I'll start with you. You looked into how prescription medication was being used through the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. Tell me what prompted this investigation for you.
Well, at our hospital, we have been seeing an increasing number of people with overdoses, almost always non-fatal ones, and surprised at the range of medications that are being taken. And about 4 years ago, we started reviewing the PBS data on opiate use and found an alarming increase in several of the opioids. We published that, and I've just updated that analysis for this presentation later today. And what we see is that the striking trend in oxycodone use has continued in the last 3 years, gone up by another 25%, and that we've seen a striking increase in two other agents, fentanyl and buprenorphine, that are now starting to rival oxycodone use. So we've, instead of having, an epidemic of one prescription opiate, we are in the midst of an epidemic of three.
And, I mean, it has been an astronomical rise in the use of opioid painkillers in the last decade, I think. I mean, over 150%. You're saying even over 175%.
It's ongoing. It has not reached the peak.
And so are opioids your main concern here, opioid painkillers?
Well, no, they're not the only concern. I just reviewed a very recent study from Sweden where they reviewed nearly 10,000 overdose deaths over 10 years in that entire country. And morphine was the number five listed drug for people to take. The number one was alcohol. Number two was paracetamol. Diazepam or Valium was number four. Dextropropoxifene was number three. We don't use it that much.
Which is?
It's part of Digesic. It's another painkiller,
right.
But it's less commonly used. And it was nearly removed from the market late last year, another story. But morphine, the most potent of the opiates, was number five. So it's telling us a very strong message that it's not just about opioids.
Not just about opioids, but opioids are really the key picture we want to talk about this morning. And I gather up to 20% of Australians suffer from chronic pain. So this whole story could be one of us better responding to the need to treat pain than before.
So the striking thing that I've found is that the National Health Survey has asked people in 1995 and 2007, 12 years apart, do you suffer with pain? Do you suffer with severe pain? And the numbers of people with pain and with severe pain both went up during this period. So it was alarming that in a period where we've got skyrocketing use of painkillers, we seem to have higher complaints of pain. So our strategy, whilst it's very important to treat pain, our strategy doesn't seem to be working.
Yes, it's a hard relationship to dissect here. Louisa Degenhardt from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre, you've been investigating at the centre the use of opioids to treat non-cancer related pain. Have you got a sense of how many people who are trying to manage their pain slip into addiction with these painkillers?
I mean, I think that's one of the issues that everyone is worried about. As Paul said, we've got increases in pain occurring in the population. We're all getting older. The Australian population is getting older. So we can only expect chronic pain to become a more, a larger problem in Australia. We are conducting a study to follow people up over 2 years to see exactly how many of those people do develop a problem with their opioids. But even when we talk to them at their first interview, some of them have been using opioids on average about 5 years, about 1 in 10 meet criteria for dependence. So it's obviously a real problem for people who are using it for a medical purpose. They're already developing problems when we speak to them for the first time.
A colleague of yours, Amanda Roxburgh, did a study into the opioid oxycodone that Paul's just mentioned, and people might know it by the name of Endone, for example. There are other names as well. What did she find out about who is overdosing on this drug or overusing it?
I think her study was really, really important because what it highlighted was the complexity of the issue. Mm. There was 465 deaths over a 10-year period. The number each year is increasing, but only 10% occurred where oxycodone was the only drug involved. Over 8 in 10 had multiple drugs on board, commonly alcohol. And they were, you know, older adults. The majority were actually female. And that's sort of the reverse of what we have typically seen for heroin-related deaths, where by far the majority are males. So even those sort of basic characteristics were different. But what was really striking was one quarter of those were suicides. Over half of those people had a recorded history of chronic pain noted at the time of death. And again, a quarter of those people were people with a history of injecting drug use.
But a lot of people did not have a history of injecting drug use.
Exactly.
So they're coming to, it seems, but it's hard to get the complete picture, that they're coming to painkiller use because of a chronic pain condition.
Definitely. But also the three groups overlapped. So you've got the overlapping mental health issues, people who are using these drugs to commit suicide, people who are living with chronic pain and accidentally overdosing, and also the group that we've typically sort of focused on, which is people who inject drugs, who are obviously using this form of opioid as well.
The picture in the US is really staggering. I think that oxycodone contributed to the largest number of drug-related deaths in North America during about a 10-year period, which is, that's staggering. I mean, people think that heroin is the big one.
Not anymore in America. The prescription opioids are bigger than cocaine and bigger than heroin. The picture isn't yet as clear here. Amanda Roxburgh, who you just mentioned before, is actually doing some more investigations to work out exactly what the picture is with opioids in Australia. It's probably not as dramatic as what they're seeing in America. But certainly the picture in America was one of people who were getting into opioid use through relatively free prescribing of a drug that many of them didn't realise was risky.
On Life Matters this morning, we're talking about some new data that indicates that the use of prescription drugs is on the rise. We're particularly zeroing in on the staggering increase in the use of opioid painkillers, for example oxycodone. And my guests are Professor Paul Haber and also Professor Louisa Degenhardt and Margaret Millington. Margaret, let me come to you now. You describe your son's drug of choice as being oxycodone. Let's talk about what led him to that point. He was 18 when he had a car accident back in 1994. What happened to Simon? Have we got you, Margaret?
Are you there, Natasha?
Oh, Margaret, we have got you. Sorry. Oh. There you are.
Here I am.
I hope you've heard us up to now, yeah?
Yes, I have, Natasha. Yes, quite clearly.
Tell us about what happened for Simon. He had a car accident back in 94.
Simon was involved in a single car accident at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And as a result of that car accident, he sustained multiple injuries to his leg, to his spine, to his hands. His foot was almost severed. And as a result of that, he was flown to the hospital in Melbourne, where he remained for 3 months. And when he finally came home after that time, we felt he had an addiction problem. And he had a number of operations following that. And at each time, we alerted the doctors to the fact that we suspected he was, and Simon knew he was addicted.
This is to the painkillers. I mean,
to the painkillers,
it must have been
yes.
very hard, though, to extract out.
It's very tricky when
an addiction. He had so
yes,
much need to relieve pain in those early days.
He did. That's right. And I think this is going back. It's 18 years now, and I think in those days there wasn't the knowledge about the drugs that there is now with regard to addiction. I think we've come a long way, but there is still a long way to come. And when you refer to OxyContin, oxycodone is a drug out there and a drug of choice that addicts are now using in place of illicit drugs because they know it's safe, they know it's affordable, and they can get it. And it's very hard for doctors to delineate between addiction or pain and demand and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate for them.
Margaret, how did you identify that Simon was having an addiction problem? What sort of lengths did he go to get oxycodone or OxyContin?
Initially, it was very hard to decide whether Simon was addicted or whether it was pain. Mm. I think initially the two crossed over. But when Simon went to great lengths, travelling interstate, doctor shopping, and not being able to function without drugs, we realised that we had a problem. And when he was on the drugs, he wasn't able to function either because he took inappropriate doses of them, and inappropriate doses were readily available to Simon.
So, I mean, you lost your boy in a way, didn't you?
And Simon said when he was on OxyContin particularly that he hated being on it but because it took away his soul, and it did. Mm. And Simon had everything to live for, but the power of addiction to those medications, he was powerless over his addiction. And, like, even the fact that he had a little girl, he had a loving, caring family, he had a meaningful life, he still reverted back to the addiction, and in the end he succumbed to that.
What role, Margaret, did you see the medical profession playing here? Because he was he made a convincing case, didn't he? He had
yes,
scars
he did.
On his body.
That's right. You only had to look at Simon. And when they're in the grips of addiction, these people, and I really feel for the medical profession and the chemists and those at the cold face, because they're very persuasive. And that's why you may be aware that we've been trying to get the real-time monitoring system implemented to help not only the addicts but their families and also those doctors and professionals who are dispensing, so that they can control and have a legitimate reason to say, we can't give you any more drugs. You've already got an OxyContin prescription from, say, Dimboola yesterday. We can't give you another one today from Horsham. And that's what Simon used to do. There was no tracking of the amounts of medications that he could get. And in the end, he was rocking from, from benzos to the opioids. And his life became uncontrollable.
Didn't he need a script, though, for the opioids?
That's correct. They were easy to get.
easy to get from different doctors.
They were easy to get, they were. And a lot of doctors, may I add, a lot of doctors are naive with regard to pain management. They start off at the top end rather than slowly, slowly trying to understand the patient and working from a lower end pain dosage to, instead of that, they'll start off by throwing a box of OxyContin at them.
I'll come to the real-time reporting that you mentioned in a tick. I want to come back to Professor Paul Haber. Paul Haber, is that something that you observe too in terms of the way in which pain medications are prescribed early on in a person's trajectory on these drugs?
Well, certainly, and this story is obviously a very great tragedy, and it's also tragic that this is not a rare event. This young man had serious multiple injuries. 3 months in hospital is a very long time in hospital, so he must have been very seriously ill. So it's hard to say that they were starting at the top end when they should have sent him out of hospital with those injuries on, you know, two Panadol a day.
Yeah.
I think this man was seriously ill. It's also a question of the assertive and continuing long-term management of people out of hospital. And again, this case highlighted multiple drugs because we heard about the use of benzodiazepines as well as the opiates. So it's all consistent with the picture that we're seeing elsewhere.
I mean, the challenge here, Paul, is that these drugs are incredibly effective at reducing pain. And so people are drawn to them when they have a chronic pain condition.
Yes. May I cut in there and say that actually there's a great deal of doubt about how effective they are.
Okay.
And particularly for benign chronic pain, there's surprisingly limited data. And when I talk to patients who have been on these drugs a long time, they'll often say these medications don't help terribly much at all. And often after talking with people repeatedly for a period of time, they start to understand that even though they have severe and unremitting pain, that these medications in their particular case may be doing not a great deal of good and significant harm, and they may start to say, well, even though I have pain, I may as well have one problem and not two problems, and start to reduce the use of medication. So the evidence that they're effective, from my experience and from the literature, is quite limited.
Well, it sounds like we need more research there, most certainly into the efficacy of these drugs. Margaret, let me come back to you. Real-time reporting, just explain more closely what that would involve and why you've become such a strong advocate, because Simon ultimately died from an accidental overdose 3 years ago now, and so this has become a very potent issue for you.
I think at the time when we were living Simon's nightmare, and if I could clarify with Paul, Simon, yeah, he certainly did need those strong medications initially, Paul. However, I was speaking from my own experience of going to a doctor and complaining of a certain backache, and then he would say, here's a prescription for OxyContin, and that's when I became aware that some doctors are naive as what is appropriate prescribing. Getting back to the real-time monitoring, we felt that we were trying to jump in front of Simon all the time to restrict the amount of medications he could get, and I tried to ring doctors and say, please don't give Simon any more oxys or this, because he's not in pain, and he admitted that at this time. Mm. But he was just feeding his addiction. And I was told in no uncertain terms that that was none of my business. And because of confidentiality, they couldn't take that on board. And then I thought, well, right, the next thing we need to do is to have a system in place where the doctors were aware that Simon had got prescriptions the day before or 2 days before, and it wasn't appropriate for him to get another prescription. And I thought, if a real-time monitoring system was in place, a live monitoring system, not something that the PBS had in place where 6 months down the track, Simon would get a letter saying, gee, Simon, I think you're taking too many opioids. It's too late then. And he just would open that letter and say, well, you know, I'd bring it to his attention, but it was a toothless tiger. Mm. However, if a doctor can go to his database and say, oh, gee, Simon, you've already got a prescription for that 2 days ago. I legally can't give you another one. Then I think it would help those who are dealing with the persuasive manner of the addicts.
Mm-hmm. Professor Louise and Degenhardt, where are we at with this proposal for real-time reporting? I gather it's got a bit sort of hamstrung by the fact that we're a federation.
Yeah, that does make things more complicated. Look, the federal government has given some money to start discussions, I guess, but the real issue will be resourcing. This is not going to be a cheap system to implement. As far as I'm aware, the states and territories are on board, but it becomes an issue of who pays for it. So I think, you know, Margaret's efforts will be really important in sort of making sure that this doesn't fall off the table, because it is going to be something that costs a lot of money, but I think it's going to be something that could be extremely important in addressing this issue.
Even if we could put in place real-time reporting, would it be the be-all and end-all on this issue? What other factors do we need to put in place or investigate to really alleviate this situation?
Well, I guess if you're talking about overdose as an issue, I think it's important to remember that some of these overdoses are suicides. They're not accidental overdoses. So it's really highlighting the issue that there's a lot of sort of coexisting mental health issues that often people who are living with chronic pain, they've often had a really shocking life history, and it's really not surprising that they are depressed. And I think sort of addressing that issue is an important one, because sort of restricting availability of opioids may not affect someone who really doesn't want to be around anymore. Mm. And I think it's, you know, there's not going to be one particular strategy that's going to address all of these things, because there is multiple problems going on here.
Now, some people have argued for I don't know the term, but it's sort of like a kind of antagonist to opioids, making those more available so that family members can have them on hand to prevent overdoses.
Yep, they've been
trying. Is that a serious argument being made?
Definitely. It's mostly been trialled to date with people who inject drugs. It hasn't really been provided in Australia so much, but it has been trialled in a number of areas in America, and it does seem to be having positive results.
Paul Haber, one issue here, I guess, is also once a person has an intractable problem with the use of painkillers, it's what sort of services they can access. And there's a lot of stigma associated with treating people with addictions. And they might not see themselves as, say, like an injecting user, for example. So are they also finding it hard to access services or reach into services?
That's certainly a problem. Firstly, there's a shortage of services for drug dependents, whether you feel stigmatised or not. And with long waiting lists, and in some parts of the country, that may be more than a year waiting time. Secondly, people do feel that they are in a very different category to injecting drug users, and they are. And for this reason, the chapter of addiction medicine has become established, or for one of these reasons, as providing specialist treatment for people with drug dependence in the community, not just in addiction centres. Mm. But that group of professionals is very slender in number and very poorly remunerated, and so they are not sufficient in numbers now or in the near future to cope with this problem. And it is very much an increasing burden. And so whilst we actually have a national prescription drug policy strategies, that's been developed, and the drug monitoring is a very important but just one of the multiple strategies that are involved with that. But we've got to look at prevention, early intervention, and then treatment across the range of pathologies. And because chronic severe pain and drug dependence is, if you like, the end game of a range of serious chronic problems that have failed to respond to whatever treatments have been thrown at it to that point, you're looking at a bunch of difficult clinical problems.
Very much indeed, as all of our stories today have indicated. Margaret Millington, special thanks to you for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much, Natasha.
And also Professor Louise Degenhardt from the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Paul Haber, Professor and Head of Addiction Medicine at Sydney University. Good luck with your presentation at the Narcotics Conference this week.
Well, thank you very much. And this does highlight why we need more research into newer and better drugs to treat pain, and that's exactly what this conference is going to be talking about.
And not just drugs. I mean, there's a sort of whole holistic story here. And I just want to check with Louisa. You're running the Pain and Opioids in Treatment, the POINT study.
Yes.
Funded by the NH and MRC. Are you still recruiting people?
We are. We're about, we need another 750 people.
Right.
So if anyone's interested
from,
in being involved.
From right across the nation?
Across the country.
Do they get in touch?
They can email us.
We'll put a link on our website.
Yeah, that
so that's what
great.
We'll do. So running the Pain and Opioids in Treatment, POINT study, the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre. We'll put details on the Life Matters website about
Thanks
that. abc.net.au/radionational/Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell back with you after a little stint on holidays. You're with Life Matters. And up next, taking a risk.